Welcome to the China in the World podcast, a series of discussions examining China's foreign policy and shifting engagement with the world. Brought to you by the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing and hosted by Paul Hanley.
This week on the China in the World podcast, we're turning the table a bit. My colleague from Carnegie's DC office, Laura Lucas Magnuson, put me in the hot seat to discuss how the recent U.S. election might impact U.S.-China relations. Laura hosts her own podcast called The World Unpacked, which dives deep into the biggest foreign policy issues with experts and journalists. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, Paul. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's great to do a joint podcast. So we are 1 week past the U.S. election and a little over 2 months until a Biden administration takes office. Before we get into what's ahead for President-elect Biden, let's talk about how we got to where we are today and the view from Beijing.
Well, thanks, Laura, for that question. As you know, I've been in China now with Carnegie Tsinghua Center for over 10 years. And one of the things I notice when talking about U.S.-China relations with Chinese interlocutors and observers of the relationship, what I hear from them is they attribute a lot of the rapid downturn in U.S.-China relations primarily to this idea of the Thucydides trap. This is Harvard professor Graham Allison's concept that these are natural tensions and dynamics that result from a diminishing U.S. power and a rising Chinese power. And as part of this narrative, there's an immense focus on Donald Trump as an individual and the actions that he and his administration have taken against China, because they're often haphazard and unexpected. And Trump, of course, is just generally a dominant and unconventional figure. But in my own view, when looking at U.S.-China, this kind of narrative attributes too much of the downturn in the bilateral relationships relationship to Donald Trump and structural forces like the rise and decline of great powers. But most importantly, I think it also, conveniently for Chinese leaders, absolves China of any responsibility for getting the relationship to where it stands today. You know, I think back to my own time in government. I had the unique experience of being a China director in the White House National Security Council, both for a Republican president and a Democratic president. And I was able to do this because both Presidents Bush and Obama used a similar framework and approach in dealing with China. But that has changed. And in large part, I think it's changed because of policies, behaviors, and actions that we see coming out of China under this new Chinese leadership, which is, you know, roughly 7-8 years old. These dramatic shifts that have been coming out of China over the past close to a decade, I think, have convinced many Americans, both in the Trump administration and outside of it, that the past U.S. policy of engagement was misguided, that it was based on this false assumption that as China developed, it would become more democratic and more market-oriented. And as the U.S. welcomed China into international institutions, that this kind of evolution would continue. To be fair, I don't actually think our approach was ever based on an assumption that this would happen. I think certainly there was a hope that this would happen, both in the U.S., but also in the broader international community. And frankly, I would argue that there has been that hope in China by Chinese people, but that has not happened. And we see that the economic reforms have reversed. We see the political tightening within China, much more authoritarian and repressive. And to the disappointment of many, I think we see China moving in these directions. And as a result of these changes, I think we're seeing a resulting hardening of views on China among U.S. elite, both in Congress and in the executive branch.
So if it wasn't personality-based, as has sort of been the general assessment during the Trump administration, was this clash of perspectives inevitable, in your opinion? And how would you describe the differences of perspectives between the two countries?
Well, I've talked about some of the changes we've seen coming out of China. There are also, I should add, as to your question about whether this clash was inevitable, you know, there are also broader structural changes going on in the relationship. We see much greater strategic competition, for example, between the U.S. and China. This is largely a new feature in the economic space. We see it in the security space, where it is both intensifying and also deepening. But there are new areas of competition between the U.S. and China, like technology, but also governance, global governance, where Xi Jinping talks about China leading the reform efforts of global governance, and that will inject a new competition between the U.S. and China. And then lastly, we see a growing ideological competition between the United States and China. So these large structural changes and forces will continue to put downward pressure on the U.S.-China relationship over the long term. But I don't think that we can also discount, as I said before, some of the pretty profound changes we've seen coming out of Beijing. I mentioned the transformation of China into a much more authoritarian and repressive country. It seems there's been, on the economic and trade side, a rejection of commitments that China made when it joined the WTO. On the military side, we see Chinese growing military capabilities. It's not just the capabilities that are concerning. It's the way they're being used to militarize and consolidate gains in the South China Sea around their claims there. Also used to ramp up military pressure on Taiwan. We see, of course, undermining the one country, two systems concept in Hong Kong with the passing of the national security recently, and even conflict along China's borders with neighbors like India. So there seems to be, in concert with growing military capabilities, growing aggressive tendencies on the part of the Chinese leadership. And all of these, both the structural changes I mentioned going on in the relationship, but also the changes that we have seen coming out of China, have culminated around the same time that Donald Trump was emerging in the last presidential campaign back in 2015, 2016. And when he was elected, I think it created a type of perfect storm for the U.S.-China relationship.
I know the question has been sort of how to describe this relationship, competitors, challengers. What label would you give it, if any?
Well, it's a great question, Laura. And I think, in describing the U.S.-China relationship today, the strategic competition piece is a new feature that is going to be very dominant, I think, regardless of who is president. And I think it will be with us well into the future. I think the way I think about it is, as we deal with a China that is more capable, more powerful, and is taking steps, policies, actions, some of which we believe undermine our own interests, I think we're going to have to do three things with China. First, we're going to have to confront China on those areas where we see problems in the U.S.-China relationship, where we see that China is not abiding by international rules and norms, where we have to actually confront and push back much harder on China. Second, I think we're going to have to compete with China. And I think when we think about the competition with China, I think we should think about it like my former White House colleague Danny Russell likes to say, competition of the sort where the New York Yankees compete with the Boston Red Sox, but not the kind of competition where you see between two rival gangs like the Bloods and the Crips, where you're trying to destroy each other. That kind of competition, I think, will be self-defeating for us and also for China and the international community. And then finally, I think the Trump administration has pretty much abandoned the notion that we could cooperate with China. But I think that I would expect, for example, a Biden administration, if it is in the interest of the United States, and if we can find a way to cooperate based on a common set of rules and make progress on issues that are in the interest of the United States and in the interest of China and the international community, we should do so. And so, again, I think strategic competition will be with us, but we'll also need to confront China. I think we can also find ways to be smart about cooperating when it's in our interest to do so.
So, Paul, how is the U.S. election covered in China what was focused in on and what might have been omitted from the coverage?
Well, thanks, Laura, for that question. And I'm also glad you asked it that way, because, of course, the presidential election was covered in China, but there were aspects of the coverage that were omitted, which are equally as important. In terms of what was covered, of course, you know, the ugly nature and the chaos of U.S. politics more broadly, the division and divisions in our country, the ugliness around the 2020 presidential election were all covered. And, you know, all of this in China, of course, serves to reinforce previously held Chinese views about the inherent flaws in the U.S. political system. And it strengthens the conviction of Chinese leaders around the validity and the relative strengths of their own political system. You know, when they sit in China and watch in the U.S., the sitting U.S. president basically going on and on about election fraud and rigging taking place, when they see the president declare victory before all the votes have been counted, refusing to concede the election, when they see that the election could turn into drawn-out legal battles, or even that there's a potential for civil unrest and violence. Of course, all of this only reinforces preconceived views of Chinese leaders that U.S. democracy is inherently instable, produces disunity and inequality, and that China's own political system, in their perspective, is every bit as legitimate, if not superior, to that of the U.S. or elsewhere. I certainly don't ascribe to those views, but these perspectives are held by many in China, including Chinese leaders. And in terms of the Chinese leadership, these perspectives are quite useful in trying to secure greater support by their own citizens of China's own political system, where they don't have to talk about the strengths or weaknesses of their own political system. They simply point to what's going on in the U.S. and say that, you know, certainly China doesn't want that. And I think Chinese leaders also recognize, and I think we'll hope to try to gain from, the hit that America's credibility and reputation is going to take globally, given that all of this has incurred. But in terms of what they omitted, one thing that we did not see, I think was purposefully omitted from the coverage in China around the election, was any language or analysis that could be interpreted as supporting one candidate over the other. The coverage was really focused on the process of the elections and not so much on how a Biden victory or a Trump victory might affect the bilateral relationship, because I think China did not want to in any way be interpreted as trying to influence the elections or favoring one candidate over the other. This is especially notable right now, of course, because President Xi Jinping, unlike many other world leaders, has yet to congratulate Joe Biden on his victory.
Right, right. Yeah, I was just going to ask how you saw the significance of that, whether it was a process issue or had some broader significance.
You know, the fact that President Xi has yet to call Biden, I don't interpret this as a slight. I think instead it's probably a calculated decision on China's part to hold off congratulating Biden until it is official, so that they don't risk provoking any sort of adverse reaction from Trump or the Trump administration during their remaining time in office. You know, I understand that in response to a question today about the prospects of a smooth transfer of power in the U.S. with regard to the election, that Secretary of State Pompeo basically said he can guarantee a smooth transition of power to a second Trump administration. It is really hard to believe he said this, and it's certainly not the image of our democracy that we want projected to the world, especially given the fact that the U.S. government is often making official statements from the White House, from the State Department, encouraging free and fair elections abroad, and for the losers in those elections to accept the results. But it does give you a sense, I think, of why Chinese leaders, why President Xi has yet to officially congratulate Biden. They're worried about the chaos and the instability of the U.S. political system right now. You know, in the past, Chinese leaders have called the president-elect once the defeated candidate conceded. And of course, that normally takes place. Many close to Trump don't think he will ever officially concede. So it's not clear what China will do in this case, and it will be very interesting to see how this plays out.
So as they are sort of watching this process unfold behind the scenes, what does your gut tell you about how they might be viewing a Biden administration, though?
Well, to talk about how China might view Biden, I think it's important for me to go back 4 years ago. As we were approaching the last election in 2016, of course, I was in China, and I remember being surprised that many Chinese friends and colleagues, even government officials, had come to the conclusion that Donald Trump would be better for China and the U.S.-China relationship because they thought he would not, that he would be more transactional and that he would not focus on human rights issues, unlike Hillary Clinton, and that given he's a successful businessman in their perspective, Chinese tend to respect and look up to successful business people. So there was really a tendency to think that Trump would be better for China. 4 years later, I think it's fair to say that Donald Trump has not turned out to be what many Chinese have hoped for, given that bilateral ties have worsened across nearly every aspect of the relationship. There's no official dialogue between the United States and China. And in the wake of the coronavirus, of course, China is now Donald Trump's number one punching bag, blaming China and not himself or the administration for the coronavirus. And senior China hawks in Trump's administration are also seizing on that opportunity to advance a number of initiatives aimed at punishing China. So I think it's fair to say the Chinese are disenchanted with Trump and are at least willing to hold out hope for what a Biden administration might bring. I think there's a recognition that Biden could actually be more effective in pushing back on China and asserting U.S. interests more prominently. They do welcome what they think will be relative stability and predictability that a Biden administration more traditional approach might bring to the relationship. I should say, having said that, I would caution, I don't think there is a consensus view on this in China. And there are others, especially among those I speak to in the Chinese strategic community. These are sort of long-term strategic thinkers who look at the first Trump administration and would think a second term of Donald Trump would be more beneficial to China. I wrote about this with my colleague Sam Bresnik a year ago in Foreign Policy, that there are those in Beijing with a more zero-sum mentality that see an unprecedented strategic opportunity for China because of the destruction that Donald Trump has done to key U.S. pillars of strength, including his gutting of U.S. political advantages, the eviscerating of America's reputation and credibility abroad, and subverting the solid alliance structure we had in the Asia Pacific. So for this group, I think Biden presents a significant challenge for China if he's able to reinvigorate American leadership abroad. And under Biden, China would lose the punching bag status that it had under Donald Trump, but it will likely be challenged on some of the key structural policies which the U.S. and other like-minded countries have been hoping to address.
Switching to the U.S. view, we're approaching the close of 4 years of President Trump's China policy, which we talked about a little bit in the last segment. But let's reflect a little bit more on these past 4 years. How would you actually describe his approach, and on what markers or measures might you assess some of the impacts?
Well, I would describe the approach by the Trump administration as extremely confrontational, treating China as a rival or as an enemy. And I think they've gone out of their way to highlight and draw attention to the growing number of challenges posed by Beijing and the problems that we have in the bilateral relationship. Unfortunately, the administration has done very little to address or try to fix the fundamental issues at hand. In fact, I would argue that the Trump administration, through its approach, has either made existing problems worse or created new problems that we now have to contend with. The approach, in my view, is often quite self-defeating. If you look, for example, at this idea of the administration cutting off all channels of communication with Beijing beyond, of course, the trade talks between Lighthizer and Lioha. While certainly it is true that the dialogue mechanisms were in desperate need of upgrade and reform, they were not as enough results-oriented. and needed to be adjusted. But instead, the Trump administration simply just abandoned all of the communication channels. Second, you know, the administration frequently has resorted to highly confrontational, antagonistic, even really race-baiting rhetoric. And I just don't think that's all that productive. And the signature policy effort by Donald Trump, the trade war, you know, has by account of many economists' estimates lowered a real GDP growth in the U.S. And it's cost hundreds of thousands of jobs without really remedying the key areas of dispute. Those issues, the structural issues, were left for phase two. Phase one was really a purchase agreement. And as many of his advisors who left the administration have noted, it was mostly about election politics. So not very effective. And the fact that Trump has taken a step back from U.S. leadership abroad and damaging our real pillars of strength with our alliances and our leading role internationally, I think this has all been pretty damaging. And as a result, we've seen bilateral ties worsen across a number of aspects of the relationship. And action increasingly takes precedence over diplomacy. There's very little diplomacy in the relationship. Both sides are now preferring to speak through damaging policies and haranguing public statements rather than the diplomacy and the discrete substantive negotiations that are needed to actually manage or resolve what are very complex and fundamental bilateral issues.
Yeah, let's turn to President-elect Biden. What do you expect to be the focus of his administration's China policy? Where might, in some cases, it be actually similar to President Trump, but where might it be different? And what are you sort of watching for in terms of those markers?
In terms of what to expect from a Biden China policy, you know, I hear some say that he will resort to a pre-Trump China policy. Some, on the other hand, say, you know, nothing will change. Strategic competition is here with us, and he's going to be just as take the same approach as Trump. I actually am more hopeful than either of those outlooks. I think there will be some important differences. And I think if China responds well, it could be helpful to the relationship. But I do agree that we should not expect a reset to a pre-Trump China policy that I think many in China hope for. There is an ongoing internal debate in the Democratic Party and specifically within the Biden camp over what future relations with China should look like. I think we will also need to see who Biden's key cabinet secretaries will be. They will have views and influence on China policymaking. And I would also not expect an early concentration on China policy from the Biden administration. I think foreign policy will be secondary to a domestic agenda, of course, focusing on COVID and reviving the economy, among other issues. Equally important, of course, will be the state of the U.S.-China relationship when Biden enters office, which could change dramatically depending on what the Trump administration does over the next 2 to 3 months. That said, I think there will be some strategic shifts in the approach, and I think they're already evident. Number one, I think important will be a dramatic shift in tone, a movement away from the hostile rhetoric, sort of race-baiting rhetoric we've seen from the Trump administration, and a renewed focus on balancing both the competitive and the cooperative elements of the relationship. Second, I think instead of this existential Cold War threat that we hear from the Trump administration, I think we will instead, from a Biden team, we'll see more of an effort to reinvigorate U.S. competitive advantages at home. As our Carnegie colleague Jake Sullivan says, U.S. should put less focus on trying to slow China down and more emphasis on trying to run faster ourselves. Third, I think a return to a multilateral approach will impact our efforts with China, revitalizing participation in key international forums like the WHO and the WTO, of course, the Paris Climate Accords, and even the Iran nuclear agreement, perhaps. And in addition, working closer with our allies and partners on areas of common concern, and especially those related to China. And then finally, democracy promotion. This is not an area that Donald Trump cares a lot about, but I do think Joe Biden does. And I think his administration will promote democracy abroad. This, of course, could be a potential area of dispute with China, as you know, one of the flagship ideas is to host a summit of democracies. And that would, of course, put more spotlight on Chinese actions in Xinjiang and Hong Kong. So beyond those changes, I think we can also expect a change in process where a President Biden would try to restore the interagency process, empower cabinet secretaries and those under the cabinet secretaries to be able to engage with their Chinese counterparts, to bring back the communication channels with China, but to have them focus, of course, more on results-oriented, getting things done, fixing problems in the relationship, try to move to a mode where we're actually solving problems with China and making progress. And I think these are important differences. If China is able to come to the table, modify its own wolf warrior rhetoric, and be prepared to address the fundamental challenges more proactively, recognizing that China has agency in the relationship too, there could be some hope to get the relationship on better footing.
Right. As of now, it appears that the Biden administration could be working with a Republican-controlled Senate. How specifically do you think that might factor into China policy?
Well, I do think a Republican-led Senate will have an impact on Biden's agenda. It will impact both his domestic agenda and perhaps his foreign policy agenda. Domestically, I think we will still see a more effective coronavirus control from the Biden administration and hopefully an early stimulus package to boost the economy. But some of Biden's most ambitious programs might be difficult to pass under a Republican Senate, notably tax reforms, Biden's climate change agenda, issues that are often contentious, like immigration reform. And so this might mean in terms of domestic policy, that many systemic issues like economic inequality and racial divides could fester. And gridlock in Washington would obviously spell trouble for some of the attempts by Biden administration to make the U.S. run faster, as I said, with regard to China, in retooling the American economy in the way it's needed for the U.S. to remain competitive globally and vis-a-vis China. And that will, of course, have implications for U.S.-China relations. Biden's policies in this area, making the U.S. run faster, could face opposition. Also, Biden's cabinet nominations may face pretty fierce opposition for approval. We've heard, for example, Susan Rice was at top of the list for Secretary of State. That may no longer be plausible, given what happened in the Obama administration, where Obama wanted to make her his Secretary of State and instead made her National Security Advisor position that doesn't require Senate confirmation. On tariffs, Biden might face some pushback in Congress if he tries to remove the tariffs, certainly if he does it without trying to get some concessions on Beijing's side, and I hope he does that. But many Republicans are maneuvering probably already, thinking about 2024, and will likely push a hardline view on issues like China and try to paint the Biden administration as soft on China. So no matter, who wins the Senate, U.S. policy toward China was already heading in a more competitive direction. And I think a Republican-led Senate is likely to only emphasize this continued shift.
Last question in this segment. Do you expect any developments or news during this lame duck period? What actions might Trump or his advisors consider taking with respect to China before inauguration and why?
Well, I'm glad you asked this question, Laura, because I do think that the period between the election outcome and the inauguration, the lame duck period, as you mentioned, I think is potentially a pretty volatile period. Our colleague, Evan Feigenbaum, this week, I heard him put it in this way. He said there's, two distinct groups in the Trump administration, those who would like to use the remaining months to burn the house down. And then there are those who simply want to box in the Biden administration, make it as difficult for Biden and his team to try to move to a more restrained relationship. And for now, I think it looks as though the box in group is driving the policy agenda, simply trying to poison the political environment so that it's more difficult for Biden to roll back some of the more impactful policies that the Trump administration has taken against China. Now, that could change. And if the burn the house down group gets the go ahead, things could become much more volatile and dangerous. I saw an Axios report over the weekend that the Trump administration, with regard to Iran, plans to slap as many sanctions as possible on Iran until January 20th. Now, that's Iran, that's not China, but it does give you a good idea of what could happen if Trump or his advisors decide to do as much damage as they can do with regard to China before getting out of office. And there's a number of things that people have talked about, laying down a number of measures and actions against China. Ironically, some of these actions might actually strengthen Biden's negotiating position vis-a-vis China. The more sanctions and tariffs and bans and executive orders that the Trump administration piles on in the next 2 to 3 months, the stronger Biden's negotiating position could be come January 20th. And if his foreign policy team is creative, they could put together a strategy to begin to roll back layer by layer in exchange for concessions from Beijing, some of these measures. I think if the Trump administration takes it, however, too far over the next 2 to 3 months, it could also, you know, dim the prospects for a Biden administration to begin to make progress on issues. You know, China so far has responded relatively restrained to the escalations by the Trump administration over the summer and in the early part of the fall. I think they've done, China has done that because wants to preserve some goodwill and space to work with the Biden administration once it's in office. But if the Trump administration pushes too far, you know, Chinese leaders have their politics too, and they may begin to escalate in disproportionate ways. And that could put the Biden team on a difficult footing as it begins its administration with and with regard to its China policy.
Paul, I want to look at the impact of U.S.-China relations on the world more broadly. Over the summer, you published a piece at Carnegie called "The World is Responding to a Changing China." Tell us a little bit more about your thesis.
We are seeing greater pushback from the international community towards China. Lucas Chan and I wrote the piece that you referred to, "The World is Responding to a Changing China," because of the troubling narrative that we have heard in Beijing over the past few years, that, you know, the rapid deterioration in U.S.-China ties is solely attributable to this notion of the Thucydides trap, that it's the U.S. that's worried about China's rise and therefore is getting more aggressive in trying to block China's rise. The fact is, however, that it's not just Washington. And as you look around the world, you see many countries and regions responding to what they see as a changing China. China is increasingly perceived in a negative way by many countries around the world. And this perception, I think, has worsened quite a bit in the wake of the coronavirus. Last month, Pew Research put out a global poll that highlighted increasingly negative international views of China. In a number of countries, mostly democratic market economy countries in Europe and in Asia, negative views had reached their highest level in the 12 or more years that Pew had been doing polling in these countries. I think that in Beijing, there is growing recognition that China has this problem. Certainly among the expert communities, we see recognition that and acknowledgement that growing anti-China sentiment is there, and that that anti-China sentiment globally, there's overlap with the views of the United States. Last May, Reuters reported that there was an internal report forward by a Chinese think tank that's associated with the Ministry of State Security that had warned Chinese leaders that global anti-China sentiment is at its highest since 1989 Tiananmen Square crackdown. So this is going to pose an even greater challenge to China now that Biden is in office, because I think that a Biden administration will work hard to shore up relations with allies and partners in the world and try to work in more coordinated and more in concert on the challenges that China presents. You know, interestingly, over the last few years from Beijing, you know, many of the European ambassadors that I talk to on a regular basis tell me that, you know, since Trump came into office, Chinese diplomats changed their approach to their meetings, and they would often open meetings, the Chinese would, by saying, you know, we see how badly the Trump administration is treating you, and we just want you to know we, China, are feeling the same way. What can we do about it together? So almost an effort, really, to gang up on the Trump administration. I think that dynamic has the potential to flip the opposite way, where the U.S. is able to align with more like-minded countries in pushing back on China's more aggressive behavior. And I would expect to see this in a Biden administration.
Yeah, let's dig a little deeper into this, because we've heard the Biden team stress renewing America's global leadership role and recommitting to its alliances, including its alliances in Asia. Where do you think that particular approach leaves China?
Well, I think clearly to answer that question, when China saw President Trump pull back from the U.S. traditional leadership role, when China saw Donald Trump undermining our alliances in Asia, I think that made China feel quite good. And so in a Biden administration where you could expect to see a renewal of America's global leadership role and an effort to maintain and strengthen our alliances, you know, I think that puts China in a more difficult position. Ironically, you know, the fact that the Trump administration has neglected our allies over the past 4 years and has turned, and in turn, this has led them, many of our allies, to have to reevaluate their own assessment of China, not with the United States necessarily there as a supporting ally. And through this different lens, I think many have hardened their views toward China. And it is with these more hardened views that a Biden administration then comes into office, which might, in fact, make it easier to find greater alignment between the U.S. and allies on where to push back on China. It might, in fact, make it easier, in an ironic way, for the Biden administration to find a more coordinated approach when dealing with Beijing. There's no guarantee that this will happen, of course. This will require hard work. And Donald Trump and his administration, I think, have done some pretty significant damage to confidence and trust in the United States abroad. And that could make it more difficult for the U.S. to get new buy-in from allies and partners. But China will now have to face a U.S. that is at least attempting to work closer with its allies and partners, and that could lead to a more effective approach in pushing back against China.
Continuing on this theme of a Biden administration re-engaging with allies and others, do you think there's any sense that the administration would rejoin the Trans-Pacific Partnership or pursue other multilateral agreements in the region to counteract Chinese influence?
Well, with regard to TPP, as you know, Laura, when Biden was vice president, he vigorously supported TPP. This was when it was being negotiated by the Obama administration. Since Biden has been in the presidential campaign, however, he has shifted his approach, saying he would not rejoin the TPP as it was initially put forward. He would insist that we renegotiate pieces of it with those countries in the Asia Pacific, so that we could bring them together more to hold China accountable. So it's this notion of working closer with allies and partners on the challenges that China presents. But even if Biden still does want to try to rejoin the TPP, or now what's called the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, the CPTPP, I think it's going to be pretty difficult. A former Singapore diplomat put it well recently. He said, you know, if Biden could make the decision privately and independently, I suspect he would probably love to go back and join the TPP. But he could get massacred domestically because the political environment against free trade agreements in the U.S. has become pretty toxic. And as our colleague Evan Feigenbaum often says, not joining the TPP means that the U.S. would not be a party to either of the two major trade agreements in the Asia-Pacific region, the CPTPP, which went into effect 2 years ago in December, and the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, the RCEP, which is expected to be signed very shortly. And this, of course, not being in either of these two trade arrangements, would have a pretty big impact on U.S. ability
to influence the region's trade and investment standards and to remain an economic force in the region. More broadly, however, I don't expect that Biden would forsake regional multilateral arrangements. As I talked about earlier, I think multilateralism will play a significant role in a Biden administration's broader Asia policy. And I think he'll try to revitalize U.S. participation in key international forums. In Asia, for example, a good example is ASEAN. During Trump's 4 years in office, he pretty much snubbed that multilateral forum, which I think is an important one. He only attended ASEAN once during his 4 years. Recently, he sent a very low-level U.S. delegation. In comparison, President Obama attended ASEAN 7 of his 8 years in office. And the 1 year that he did not attend, he only skipped it because of a government shutdown. So I expect Biden will once again reverse this trend and make it a priority to show up throughout his time in office. And I think the same goes for our key relationships, for example, with Japan and South Korea. You know, they have had some deterioration in ties, and the U.S. has typically, under previous administrations, played a pretty important role in trying to work, mediate, and help those two allies work out their differences. And I would expect the same under a Biden administration.
Finally, also on multilateral diplomacy, while you were in the White House, you served as a White House representative to the six-party talks. What should we be looking for from North Korea in the coming months? How do you think a Biden administration will try and tackle this problem?
Well, with regard to North Korea, I think the thing we need to watch for, of course, is the possibility that North Korea early on in a Biden administration takes provocative actions, you know, a missile test, long-range ballistic missile test or a nuclear test, or even a cyber attack. Again, early on in Biden's presidency, in order to try to, you know, extract U.S. concessions, you know, basically bribe the U.S. and other key powers in the region, try to get relief on sanctions, and to try to reset the table for negotiations more in North Korea's favor. This would be typical North Korean behavior to try to intimidate a Biden administration early on, make sure that the Biden administration remembers that North Korea is there. They don't want to be ignored. But unfortunately, that kind of provocation, I think, if North Korea goes through with it, could have the opposite effect. It could squeeze political space the new administration wants to try to come up with more creative and more problem-solving approaches to actually make progress on the North Korean nuclear issue. You know, if you look at the Trump administration's approach, we've seen obviously a lot of reality TV summit diplomacy where, you know, President Trump has had this love affair with Kim Jong-un. But the fact is that after 4 years, the nuclear threat that North Korea poses is much more dangerous than it was when Trump came into office. Because basically, Donald Trump, at the Singapore summit, he accepted the Chinese proposal of freeze for freeze. This is a proposal that the Chinese had been putting forward to the Obama administration, and they rejected outright several times, because the proposal basically says that North Korea would stop its missile tests and nuclear tests if the United States and South Korea would stand down on what they call, you know, provocative war games. Well, number one, yes, we don't want North Korea to test missiles and test nuclear devices, but mostly we don't want North Korea to build its missile inventory and develop more weaponized nuclear material, which they have done over the past 4 years of the Trump administration. Second, the notion that North Korea developing this rogue nuclear program is somehow morally equivalent to the U.S. and South Korea as allies trying to legitimately prepare and train their military forces in the event that North Korea follows through on their threats is something that the U.S. should not accept. Donald Trump accepted that. He did that, by the way, without working through South Korea. South Korea was surprised at the Singapore summit when Donald Trump said that the U.S. would stand down on its military exercises in exchange for North Korea not testing missiles and develop and doing nuclear tests. And that's the third point, which is, I think under a Biden administration, we will get back to working with our allies, South Korea and Japan, and even working really with China. You know, we have to find ways to work with China, even if we have difficult tensions in the relationship. We got to find a way to work with them on North Korea if we're going to make real progress.
Well, thanks so much, Paul, for helping us unpack this really complex relationship between China and the United States, and certainly uncertainty and bumpiness ahead potentially. But thank you so much for being on.
Well, thank you very much, Laura, for having me on The World Unpacked. And I really am excited that we've done this as a joint podcast with the Carnegie Tsinghua Center's China in the World. And I hope we have the opportunity to do it again. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the China in the World podcast. For more episodes and research, please go to carnegietsinghua.org. This episode was produced by Lucas Cheyenne with assistance from Madison Reed, Luke Incarnation, Li Chi Shu, John Ferguson, and Sophia Rosso.